Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. Today is the first Thursday of February, and we're starting a new topic. And our topic today is oral tradition. And this has been a controversial part of our practice, as well as being a kind of confusing part of our practice. And it's really good to talk about it because there is a balance between how to use our modern information age technology and support the oral tradition. Anyway, this is my hope that myself and others who practice Reiki will be able to arrive at a good balance. Some people think that oral tradition is really a past value, that it's something that doesn't have any room or any, there's no place for it in our age, because everything can be, information can be exchanged so rapidly, and over a very large amount of people. And this, for me, is exactly why oral tradition is very valuable in our practice. It's like there's a part of what we have learned over the years about oral tradition that have really increased my tenacity for this practice to remain oral tradition. Today I have with me Phil Morgan, who has been on the show before, and I've really enjoyed our conversations. And this time he comes to us with his own experiences of oral tradition, with perhaps his own questions, and perhaps an insight into oral tradition that comes from other practices that he has taken part in that also remain oral traditions. So, Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Phyllis. It's great to be here.
So, you know, at the beginning, and so I just want to do this little intro, at the beginning of oral tradition, well, at the beginning of my practice as a master and for the group of masters after Hawaii Takata died, oral tradition was sort of explained as there are no books written about Reiki, which is what she said, that there no books should be written about Reiki, and that there weren't any at the time, which if people are coming into Reiki today is hard to believe, but it was true. This was in the late 1970s. Very shortly, I don't know, I think 1983 or something, the first book was published, not just the stories of Hawaii Takata, but about Reiki itself, of explaining the practice of showing hand positions and so on. And these books that first came out were teaching manuals. And then a German couple published another book of their experience with Reiki, although they, I don't think, had been initiated at the time. And this went on proliferating until now there are hundreds of books of all facets of Reiki and all different practices of Reiki. So we had to, the older generation, had to dig down deep into our understanding of oral tradition and come up with other characteristics, other qualities, other advantages to having an oral tradition, because it seemed at this moment in time, which was in the mid-1980s, that oral tradition was really going downhill fast. So, you were a student at that time.
I was.
How did that feel to you?
Very strange, because I saw these books starting to come out, and I would go to the books, and the information would be a little bit different, or a lot different than what I was being presented with in the classes I was attending. And it lacked the energy that I felt when I was in the class, listening to the teacher. And so I recognized very early on in my path with Reiki, that that wasn't a way for me to get the information about
mm-hmm.
Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to acknowledge and appreciate your tenacity. I love that word. Because it's so easy to turn to the technology, it's to turn to the books to get the quick bit of information. And one of the things in my practice, in my studies, both in Reiki and in shamanism, is oral tradition makes me listen with my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I can really understand what's going on. And I spent 25 years in the computer field, and it's real easy for me when I'm listening to something on the computer or reading something to just have it be a more mental process. I have to really focus on taking it in from that kind of media
mm-hmm.
in the way that it's fairly natural for me to do when I'm listening or seeing somebody and I'm in their energy and I'm with them.
Mm-hmm. So as a student, did you want to have written material? I mean, was that something that you kind of would have liked to have had in the moment?
Well, of course, coming out of the computer field at that point in time, yes, I'd love to have a manual. You know, tell me, and you and I went through that process, and thankfully you were tenacious and didn't let me get by with it. But I wanted to have my checklist of, you know, what do I need to do to become a Reiki master? What do I need to do to have a practice? You know, tell me the things. And you kept telling me, I don't know. You've got to figure them out. Listen to what your heart says. And after a few years, that finally sunk in, and I got there. But that was a tough time to give up mm-hmm. the side of my brain that had been so valuable for so long in the computer field.
Right. But, you know, one of the things that I wasn't very good at the time, because I was also struggling with the same process. And I hope that I'm more maybe tactful, I don't know, about it now. But I see that if we feel like we need to open one part of ourselves, that we have to shut down the other part.
Mm-hmm.
And more, especially in my process these days, I just see that there's a balance that I'm seeking.
Absolutely.
And that you can't run your heart without your mind, and you can't actually have a good mind without heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would like to explore the concept of heart.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, I think, sort of equate heart with Valentine's Day. Do you know what I mean? I mean, symbol of love and light,
right.
And a lot of times a love that none of us have really experienced.
Right.
So, you know, we're out there looking for some ideal, and, you know, if it feels right, or it feels like this is a loving thing to do, then this is obviously the right thing to do. And I don't know, I don't have a lot of words to articulate it, but I feel that in these last 30 years, I've grown to understand more what heart is about, and it's not just about Valentine's.
Absolutely not.
No. Do you have any kind of
assistance? To equate it to is my understanding of the process that we're in now in our evolutionary step of understanding that we have this wonderful brain, I also call it my mind, that is really good at making decisions, sorting out facts, letting me know when there's danger around, helping me get through life on the physical level.
Storing information.
Comparing information.
Uh-huh.
But there's this other part of me that is really more my consciousness or my heart. And to me, those two things have become more and more synonymous.
Uh-huh.
My awareness, my consciousness, is if I'm feeling that I'm able to listen from that point, if I feel like I'm able to speak from that place, that it's a very different communication. It's a very different experience than doing it from my head.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have always thought it was interesting that the Japanese language has this concept, heart-mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word is kukuru. And it is something that is taught in the martial arts also, that you have to be connected physically with your heart in order to be able to draw a sword and kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for them, is the highest honor. Anything else is just rampage.
Right. Yeah, vengeance, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, madness, really.
Yes.
And I think that one of the things that has been very interesting for me in my work with Reiki is that a lot of times words are our natural weapon. And when it comes from our mind or comes from fear or comes from a place of what we might call reaction, then quite often words become the most lethal weapons that we have.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So it's an interesting part then to be able to want to move into and understand more about what oral tradition is and how to use words from this heart-mind connection rather than from reaction and rather than from wanting to control or fear or whatever the other things.
Yeah.
And I think that the emphasis on oral tradition in our practice keeps drawing us back to this place. That I would like to see it, I would like to think of it as a very profound teaching that just comes with the territory of practicing Reiki.
Absolutely, yeah. Anything now, at least in my life, anything I can find that helps me strengthen that place of consciousness, awareness, heart, is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, Reiki certainly fits into that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we then go from that part of oral tradition to another perspective of it, as a master, I have fought for many years with other masters and with students about the need for teaching manuals and information to go out. And it seemed like in the recent months, I've been musing on this a lot because two women have offered to write a book about my life in Reiki, and I'm not very taken with it. But on the other hand, two individual people from very different sides of the planet have come to me with this request, and so I have to also listen to it.
Sure.
And not just totally dismiss it out of hand. Meanwhile, there is this part of me that really likes the moment-to-momentness or the presence of an oral tradition where information and energy is passed simultaneously to a student, sometimes not even because of the words that are said, but because of the words that are not said.
Or because of the energy that's held in saying the words that are said.
Right. Which can't be, I don't think, can't be communicated through a book. And I don't know. I don't know how to balance this voracious appetite we seem, as a society, seem to have these days for information. And I'm wondering if you have any great ideas about this.
I don't know about great ideas. Well, to me, there's this... aspect of oral tradition, which is storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And so there are a lot of different ways to tell a story. And some of that the effectiveness of, or the choice of which way is most effective, comes back to what is the story about.
Uh-huh.
So some stories are about facts, and they're about helping somebody understand a sequence or a process.
Uh-huh.
That can be written very easily and very clearly. Some stories are about history, and some of that can be written, but sometimes it's, you know, like video is helpful because you can weave in more to the story. Sometimes the story is about personal experience and wanting to have that kind of personal connection with the storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then books and videos don't do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a matter of apprising ourselves or being aware of what's the story we want to tell and what's the tool that allows us to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would never hand a first-degree student a book and say, oh, by the way, read the book and if you have any questions, call me. Because they aren't going to get the connection with Reiki. They aren't going to get my experience of Reiki. They aren't going to get the experience of Reiki that has come to me through the lineage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not possible to share it in that way. But if they get really confused about the hand positions, maybe something that helps them remember is possible to put in print. I don't like that particularly for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's a pretty simple thing to remember. And if they don't remember, then they can just put their hands on the other person any place.
Right.
It still works.
Right.
So, you know, there... Yeah. So I think there's a place for books. I enjoy reading. But I don't go to books to find out the core essence of something. I go to a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that
yes.
Sorted mm-hmm. out a little bit?
Yeah, I think that oral tradition is something that has been challenged quite a lot in our in the last 30 years. And what I find quite interesting at this moment now, with the advent of Facebook and those kinds of things which I actually don't use, and I'm resisting even. I haven't accepted any invitations, and I've resisted even going there. But I see that it's another way for people to have conversations, mm-hmm. and for me, this is much easier than email, because or the chat rooms, because there's something more personal. I don't know why. It just has this feeling. There's something more personal about the connections, and I don't know if that's true. And do you have a sense of that?
Well, my daughters all use Facebook. So they're always after me to do more with it, and I have a Facebook page, but I don't ever check it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Maybe this is a where the generation gap appears in our computer.
Part of it is I haven't taken time to learn the technology and all the little nuances of Facebook. The other part is that I'd rather call them up on the phone and hear their voice.
Right.
Or use Skype or something like that,
right.
I can even see them.
Yeah.
So I'm just, you know, and sharing things, it's like, what is it, Twitter, where you've got so many words and you've got to fit everything you want to say into...
Well, I have no idea, but that sounds terrible.
40 words or something like that. I don't do that either.
Uh-huh.
I don't Twitter.
You don't
tweet? I don't tweet. Quit Twitter or anything. No.
Well, those people who are on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, I'm sure that they have this sequence down, and it's an interesting place to go. But as you said, what is it that you are trying to communicate? What is it that you want the listener to receive? And what is it that you want to receive back?
Right.
So oral tradition for me takes into consideration these three things. And I feel that, you know, when you read a book about Reiki, any of you listeners out there, first ask yourself, what is your motivation to read the book? And if it's to gain information about the right way to do Reiki, you're not going to get it. You know, all the books that have been written about Reiki are an expression of that author's experience of Reiki. It is not an oral tradition. It's not something that is alive, because the truth lies in your practice of Reiki. The truth does not lie in somebody else's practice of Reiki.
Exactly.
So I think that this is a really interesting division. And then if you are willing to just say, oh, well, I want to see how so-and-so feels about Reiki treatments or whatever, and I'm going to read this book, that's great. Then notice what you receive from it. Notice what you feel like the author is wanting you to receive. And notice if there's some response back that you can give. And of course, now everybody has web pages and so on where you can actually have a cyclical kind of communication with the author, which I think is really great.
Yes.
Because it allows books to then become alive. Otherwise, you know, books become very static. And, you know, that author in 5 years is going to write a very different book than what they wrote 5 years earlier about Reiki, because it just will be different.
Sure. Their experiences will change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting kind of parallel, but I think, you know, our justice system and the place of the trial court. There's evidence prepared and presented that's in written form, but the arguments and the presentation of the case is all oral. And you have a chance then to cross-examine and to say, but I didn't understand that, or that doesn't seem to agree with this. And it's done in real time. And that's what I love about being with a teacher and understanding, you know, that kind of process of interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than reading a book and sending an email to the author and saying, on page 142 you said this and I don't quite understand what that meant.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, there seems to be degrees of it all. So where do you lay down the line?
with what?
Well, let's say in with your first degree students.
With my first degree students, I basically start my class by saying, I'm going to give you an access to this energy that you will be using in your life, and you can forget everything I teach you, everything I tell you, and everything that you've seen in print, and you will know how to do this. It's part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I try and take away the any sense of needing to have information.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I'm not going to answer their questions. It's not that I won't respond to them if they email me or phone me. But it's wanting them to acknowledge that this is an experiential process that's going to build over their lifetime. And the class is just a step of making that connection more real for them, helping them pay attention to it, helping them have a way to access and use that energy in their life. And then it's up to them to go put their hands on themselves and others and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that you can read about or even hear about. I can share with them my stories of my experiences, but they're going to have their own. And I love it when the students come back and say, oh, I had this really neat thing happen, and I get to hear their stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I had to do as a young master is let go of trying to teach people the right way through an oral tradition. Because you know, it's like, especially when I was doing master trainings, I would say to the young masters, if you want to do a trade for money,
mm-hmm.
Think very carefully about this. And, you know, try to find equal value and so on. And, you know, every master who went through this training had to have their own experience.
Right.
Of this particular process.
My hands up on that one.
Yes, including myself. I mean, that's where I learned it. And I remember this great, this little quote from one of Krishnamurti's books of these dialogues that he had with his students. And he said, you know, one of the failings of a human being is that we cannot learn from somebody else's experience. Excuse me. And it is also one of the gifts of being human.
Yes. Yeah.
So I've always remembered that and tried to, excuse me, tried to teach in that particular manner, knowing that I can share my experience. And only after the person has their experience will they go, oh yeah, Phyllis said something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know what she meant.
Yeah.
And, in the beginning, I always would think that that particular process was a failure of the oral tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what I realize now is it's actually the nature of the oral tradition.
Yeah.
So,
and the strength of it.
And the strength of it. Yeah, because we either we carry these conversations with us, and even now, in some moment unknown to me, I'll be going, well, I don't know what I should do here, or well, I guess I'll do this, and then I'll hear my grandmother's voice say something to me, and I'll go, wow, I haven't thought of that in years. So her voice and her teaching and everything still is within me. So this fear of us in this day and age to not remember, I would really, I think that remembering has a kind of connotation of being able to access information immediately, like a computer.
Mm-hmm.
But really remembering for me is when you are in a situation and you need the information, it will be there.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't be there before, or after.
Which is, to me, that listening with your heart, because that's our consciousness stepping in and giving us the guidance when the brain can't figure out what to do next.
Could you say that again?
That memory that we have when you hear your grandmother's voice or I hear your voice is that's the heart that's listened. That's the consciousness speaking back to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our brain, the brain cells clicking and putting things together. Those are facts. Those are things I forget.
Mm-hmm.
But when I touch back into an experience I had
mm-hmm.
in listening to you, then to me, that's my conscious awareness. That's my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten how to program computers using Fortran and BASIC and all that stuff. But I remember the experience of doing it. And I remember the experience of seeing that first program work when I finally got the code all right.
Wow.
And that touched my heart to
mm-hmm.
see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing of listening to someone and
mm-hmm.
and hearing their experiences. I had a chance to listen to a wonderful old Tibetan Buddhist monk, Chagden Rinpoche, and I'll never forget sitting in that room and listening to him and watching him and hearing his stories and his experiences. No, they're a part of me because they touched my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think recalling those experiences, recalling those memories of consciousness are what really guide us in Reiki
mm-hmm.
and in relating to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of, for me, it's part of the practice, and it's part of what I want to share with my students. I don't feel like I mean, I know the process of initiation, Mm-hmm. But what I really have to share with my students is my experience with the energy and get them excited about finding their own experience with the energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a head trip.
Mm-hmm. 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 So when you, after you were in Reiki and were a Reiki student, did you then find your way to shamanism, or was that a...
They came pretty much at the same point in time, because I did first degree in March of 83 and second degree in like September of 83, and in January of 84 I took 3 months off of my job because my world was turning upside down and I didn't know what the heck was happening. And I went on a retreat, and I ended up at Brighton Bush Hot Springs in Oregon. And there was somebody teaching shamanism there, and I didn't have anything else to do, so I went to the class. So they kind of came together.
Uh-huh.
And to me, they've always been very linked.
Uh-huh. So in your experience of what you call shamanism, which would be nice to have some kind of definition of that, just for context sake, then that's also taught in an oral tradition.
Right. Yeah. Because all I could learn from my teachers in the shamanic practice was how to connect with the spirit world. How to do that in a way that honors the spirit world, that honors myself and the people I'm working with, that keeps me safe, keeps the people I'm working with safe. But what happens out there in the spirit world, nobody can tell me.
Uh-huh. You can't get training or information.
No. I mean, you can get kind of a process or maybe a general idea, but that's their experience of what happened for them when they went out there. And the only way to find out what's going to happen for you when you, is to go out there and find out.
Sounds a lot like Reiki.
It does. Very much.
Oh, interesting. And
I think there's a little more trust involved in relationship with the spirits out there, but
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like Reiki is, I don't know if they would be synonymous. I don't think so. But there's a lot of things that happen when we practice Reiki that is not very obviously logical. And
right.
that induces distrust.
It can, yes.
It can.
Yep.
Well, I know for a lot of students it definitely
it
raises
them.
Questions.
Yes.
And there's a part where I can reassure people, but I can't give them trust.
Absolutely.
You know, which is another thing, another quality of oral tradition that I find very interesting.
It's like one of my teachers, told me how to keep myself safe in the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
And I had somebody that I was working with, and they needed help.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my spirit helpers, I'm going to go help them. And they said, don't do it. And I said, what do you mean, don't do it? I'm here to do it. That's why I came. That's what this is all about. I'm going to go do it. And he said, don't do it. And I did it. And I paid the price for doing that. I was totally paralyzed from the waist down for 4 hours after that.
Wow.
And it gave me a really wonderful lesson. It was actually, considering what could have happened, it was probably a pretty mild lesson. But it got my attention. I understand that now, that if my spirit helpers say, don't go there, I don't go there.
Uh-huh.
And I sometimes have had to come back to the client and say, I'm sorry, I can't go there. And that's been really hard for me to accept that there are some things I can't do.
Uh-huh. Like saying no to giving someone a Reiki treatment, for instance.
I've never done that.
No?
I've never said, no, I won't give you a Reiki treatment. I've said, maybe, for instance, I've just had a really nice pitcher of beer and I'm not in any shape to give them a Reiki treatment. So we do it tomorrow instead of tonight.
Right.
But Now, other than something like that, I've never refused to give somebody a Reiki treatment.
Interesting.
Because I trust that. That's some of the difference, I guess, for me between Reiki and shamanism. I just really trust that my job is to put my hands on the person. That's all. I can't determine what happens to it. I can't stop it from happening. I can't... most of the times, I can't even interpret what's happening. But if I've done what Takata talked about, hands-on Reiki on, that's my job. And then the rest of it, I leave up to Reiki and that person and their soul.
Mm-hmm.
With shamanism, it's a much more active process for me. I'm involved in making that decision about, you know, no, I can't do this, or I can't do it now, or the spirits are not supporting this, or you need to take... I had one client that she was in a horrible relationship, and she wanted a soul retrieval, and the spirits said, there's no point in doing a soul retrieval, for she'll go home and lose them all. You need to tell her to get out of the relationship. And that was really difficult to come back and say to her. And a year later, I did a soul retrieval for her. She got out of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And she was much happier. So I don't have those kinds of things come up for me in the Reiki treatments.
Uh-huh.
I don't have to make that decision or
say,
I'm sorry, I put my hands on you, but the Reiki's not doing anything, so there's no point in doing this. That's never happened.
No, yes, that's true for me too. However, I did have a person who came to me who was a very new second degree student, and she said, you know, I'm sending Reiki to my partner, and what happens is I just get totally enraged, like I just feel all this anger coming up. And she said, you know, I don't really understand it, but he abused her.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what is your motivation to sending Reiki? And she said, I want him to change. And I said, well, I'm not sure that's going
to
happen.
To me, that's not giving a Reiki treatment.
Oh, I see.
that's outside.
Okay, that's clear.
That's outside the definition of giving a Reiki treatment.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I have, you know, when I give a Reiki treatment, I have to be in a position where whatever happens is okay.
Uh-huh.
And it's not my agenda about what's happening. One of the gifts, one of the lessons that you gave me in oral tradition was if you want to treat somebody, treat yourself first. Because if you want to treat them, then you need to understand what your agenda is and why you have it.
Yeah. Like if you have a...
if you're trying to fix somebody,
that's not
a Reiki treatment for them, from my perspective.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good definition.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting.
And that was oral tradition from you.
Oh, thank you. Thank me. Okay,
thank
I have
you.
Another instance.
Sure.
Well, a friend of an acquaintance of mine, I will say, she wasn't really a friend. An acquaintance of mine came to me and said, you know, I have a really bad kidney infection. I'd like for you to treat me with Reiki. And I knew a little bit of her history, and I knew that she had an aversion to allopathic medicine, and that she had been fighting this, whatever was going on in her body, for several months. And she looked terrible. I mean, she was really in bad shape. And I said, well, you know, I would be willing to treat you. So what happened for me is I just got inside no. And I said to her, I feel that you should go to the hospital and find out what's actually going on with you. And then come back to me and I would be willing to give you a Reiki treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And... she didn't like it very much, but she eventually did go to the hospital, and it was important for her to have gone. I don't remember the details, but I do remember that it saved her life. And you know, somebody could say, well, if I had given her the Reiki treatment, that might have saved her life. Well, it might have. But at some point, I feel that intervention, you know, Reiki balances, you know, in my mind, Reiki balances our natural processes. And there are times when intervention with another kind of healing is helpful.
Well, absolutely. Sure, sure.
Yeah.
To me, Reiki gets called complementary medicine, but I think all medicines should be complementary.
With each other.
With each other, yeah. Whether they're allopathic or homeopathic.
Right.
And I, you know, I don't know what I would do in that situation. I think my tendency, without being faced with having to make the decision, would be to say, okay, lay down on the table, I'll give you a treatment, and then we'll go make an appointment with your doctor.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
One of the things I actually tell my students, and maybe I need to hear another oral tradition from you, is that the only way they can misuse this gift is to not offer it to somebody that needs it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's, you know, that's having been given this incredible gift, having been given the ability to have a form that I can share it with somebody else, and then to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'd have a really hard time with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think...
And I can kind of understand the, how do you give the, somebody the incentive or the encouragement or the support to go do something that you see as, you know, really necessary or would be very helpful. I would not ever want somebody to take a Reiki treatment and then say, well, I don't need to go to the doctor now.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen too many cases where I've given somebody a Reiki treatment and they go, oh man, I feel so much better, thanks so much, and they get up and they overdo it and then they're back in bed again.
Right. But that's another learning.
But that's another learning.
Yeah. That's another learning. Yeah. I think that where I come from in this place of, which is an interesting conversation, is that sometimes there is a no, and I feel that we should honor that no inside of us, whatever the situation is, because I trust our intuitive self or our heart more than into our mind.
Absolutely, I agree totally with that. I just have not had the experience of.
So sometimes no's come up for students, especially young students, because they don't feel capable or they don't know if they can really handle the consequences of what's happening. So I feel that at that point, it's not a limitation of Reiki. It's a limitation. It's a personal limitation,
sure,
which I feel like needs to be honored.
And that's where I get into kind of pushing people. I just worked with a couple in Hawaii, and he'd had a massive, massive heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife was just terrified that if she put her hands on him, he was going to die, or he was going to die anyway. And she'd put her hands on him with Reiki, and his heart would start aching a little bit. And he'd go, oh, stop, stop, stop. And it was like... helping them find that place where she could touch him and she could support his healing process and he could open that space up to allowing her to do that, and both of them could basically treat their fears along with the physical stuff that was going on with him.
Because
they were living in fear every day, night that they went to bed. She was afraid he was going to have another heart attack in the middle of the night, because that's when it happened. And so she was a
friend. So did they move through that?
They're in the process of moving through.
But here is a really good example of the value of oral tradition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because every situation is different.
They could never have read a book and gotten the kind of support I was able to give them by being there with them. Somebody who'd written the book couldn't see them and know what the problem was and how to address it.
Right.
Yeah. And even over the internet, that those kinds of, they wouldn't have asked the question.
Right. Or
they wouldn't have known how to put out that.
Well, you know, there's this other part, too, where I don't know if you as listeners have experienced this, but, you know, there are just some times when I need to put my hands on people to get the full experience of what's happening. Mm-hmm. I know that in my case, right now, there are lots of people who would like to put their hands on me and find out what's really going on. And, I mean, you know, distant treatment has been remarkable in that, because I feel like people have been able to touch me without hordes of people coming and, you know, being with me physically. But there's a real understanding for me about being with somebody and getting, oh, are they really going to die now? Is, you know, what do I need to say to them to complete and to be feel complete in our relationship? You know, what is it that I can offer them, you know, out of my heart, and so on. So mm-hmm. It's like, that's another aspect of oral tradition that's very interesting.
Well, that's the being with another person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's that, one of the dynamics, or one of the gifts in oral tradition, especially when it's face-to-face, is that witnessing for each other.
Now, what does that mean?
Being able to really see the person I'm talking to. To hold, sometimes like hold the mirror for them, sometimes to understand that what they need is an embrace, to see that little flash of confusion go across their face when I say a word, and know that they didn't quite get that, and I need to go back and look at that again. So there's, you know, what I loved about the oral tradition aspect is that there's a responsibility on both parties. The speaker not only has the responsibility to share clearly about whatever their subject is, but they also have the responsibility of paying attention to the people that are receiving that. And the people that are receiving not only have the responsibility of listening with their heart, but also of paying attention to what gets in their way of hearing the message. This woman, the wife of this man, you know, had a difficult time hearing that it was okay to put her hands on him. And that he might feel something. And he probably would feel something, because his body's going to respond to the energy. And that's part of the healing process. So I think that the gift of, especially the face-to-face oral tradition, is that we get to see each other, and I get to witness what you're going through, and you get to witness what I'm going through and sharing it.
Yeah, beautifully said. Well, Phil, we have just a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you have any pieces about oral tradition that you would like to share with the listeners. Anything?
Well, one of the things when we started talking about the subject that came back was the old telegraph game. Remember that? Where you have the circle of people kind of share the story and see what the story ends up like it started out. And there's, especially in the shamanic tradition and in the indigenous cultures, there is a recognition of responsibility in listening to the story and being able to repeat it accurately. I think in our Western culture, we've lost some of that respect, some of that acknowledgement, some of that recognition. We don't have it be a part of our lives. And when some beautiful practice like Reiki comes into our life, and oral tradition is the basis of that, we don't have a context to put it in where we understand that when we go to a Reiki class and listen to the teacher sharing the information, or when we hear you on the radio, or in one of the programs that you have, it's our responsibility to hold that information with respect, with honoring, with a recognition that if I'm going to share it, I need to share it accurately, with integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is a part of the oral tradition that's probably the most difficult for us to get in mm-hmm. our culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because when we talk about oral tradition, one of the other assumptions was that it was about the person speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a two-way street.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And listening is as important, or maybe, yeah, is as important as speaking.
Yes.
And the quality of listening that is happening in the world today is regretfully
lacking.
Well, it's regretfully shadowed or colored by our own assumptions about what's going on.
And we think we can do it once. In traditional cultures, that story is repeated, and I, as a child, I hear it when I'm laying in my mother's arms, and I hear it as an adolescent, and I hear it as a young adult, and it, you know, and I get a chance to repeat it maybe when I get to be an elder,
right?
And I've heard it for 40 years of my life,
right.
Repeated over and over and over the same way. In our culture, we think we can listen to it once, turn around, and tell the story.
Well, that's true.
We can't.
Mm-hmm.
We can't. It's not part of our facilities. We're human. We interpret and we translate and we try and understand and we miss some words and we, you know, put it into our own context. And then if we're lucky, we get to go hear the same story over again and we go, oh, wow, it's like going, I love Avatar's the new film, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm really into Avatar.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going back to it over and over again because there is so much in that that the first time I saw it in 2D, which was very, I love the story, but it was not the same experience as it was in digital 3D, which I had a chance to do.
Wow.
And I heard different things and I saw different things I think probably I could see it another dozen, two dozen, three dozen times, and then I'll really get the story.
Uh-huh.
And we go to a first-degree Reiki class, or we go to hear somebody talk, and, you know, we hear it once, and then we go out and we're experts on it.
Right. Well, I feel that one of the things that used to happen with my grandmother, and also does happen in some communities, small local communities, is that students are really encouraged to review classes, to hear the story again. And when you were talking about in the Aboriginal cultures that you hear it as a babe in your mother's arms, you know, all the way through your life, I was just thinking that, you know, what's really wonderful is the story stays the same, but the listener grows. And in that, the depth of understanding of the story grows also. Mm-hmm. So the circle that we have of story, by the time it's heard after the 150th time or something,
mm-hmm.
then there is maturity of the listener.
Yes.
And I feel like that can also be true for Reiki students. So you listeners out there, if you are inspired and have the opportunity to go and review a first degree class from your master or another master of a similar teaching, excuse me, do so, because perhaps then you will have more of an understanding of the depth of oral tradition and what it can bring to you in your actual daily Reiki practice.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Well, Phil, thank you very much for being with me this hour.
It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been wonderful for me too, and great conversation.
Great.
If I do say so myself.
And they always are.
And for you listeners, take a listen to oral tradition, and in your families, you can instill this also in your children. I loved Susan Mitchell, especially, who used to have the scrapbook of her baby pictures and, you know, would tell her story to her children from when they were babes and, you know, all the way through their adolescence and so on. And it's a beautiful situation. So we can repeat oral tradition and create its value in our children, which will actually make a difference, I think, in the future of our planet. So I'm Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, balancing form and essence.